From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie. Welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, open lines, and for just a short time tonight, we're going to let your minds wander and try to escape the events that have been happening on this planet over the past week. The world is indeed in chaos. Turkey. The Turkey president has been greeted now by large crowds at Istanbul's main airport early Saturday morning there as forces loyal to him battled to fend off a military coup that has left at least 60 people reportedly killed and dozens more injured. Out there at a news conference, the prime minister said that the architects of the coup attempt would pay a heavy price and vowed that he would not surrender this country to intruders. Apparently, the coup is over. The current president, of course, still in power, but it's still a little unclear out there at this point. My sources, people who have lived in Turkey, tell me that there are some issues with this current administration out there, that they're not all pro-American, as you would think, that the military is more pro-United States than the elected official is. And what they tell me, too, is that one of the sons of the president of Turkey, the prime minister there, has been dealing with ISIS oil, getting tankers and making a huge amount of money on ISIS oil. You're not going to hear that on any media in this country because they don't know about this. But apparently it's the word out there in Turkey. And I have to tell you this, too, is because many of my relatives were born in a very small town called Mardin, Turkey. Right now, the population of that town is about 89,000. At the time they were all there, it was about 22,000. It was heavily Christian at the time. This is back in the 1920s. And our people fled. Many of them were slaughtered. I had an uncle, Colonel Leon Norrie, served in World War II in the Air Force. He was an Air Force intelligence officer. He died at the age of 100 a few years ago. But he used to tell us that his great-great maternal grandmother, who died apparently at the age of 125, was beheaded during the genocide in the 20s out there in Turkey. And before they beheaded this 125-year-old woman, they forced her to watch her entire family, including a little six-year-old girl, get beheaded by these people. This was during the Armenian genocide a long time ago. Now, we're not Turkish, but that's where they were and that's where they lived. And at that time, it bordered, it still does, Iraq. Those regions were wide open. In Nice, France, the world in chaos. Cars and trucks were barred from the promenade yesterday during these festivities. So how in the heck did this 19-ton truck barrel in for a mile into the crowd of revelers, killing at least 84 people, injuring 200 others? The driver, of course, a 31-year-old from Tunisia, was shot dead. We're finding out a lot of things about this guy. One, he told police that he was delivering ice cream, so they let him in. They didn't let anybody in, but they let him in. But this guy apparently was going through a divorce. He had three kids, and apparently he was not tied to any terrorist group. They're trying to figure out what made him go nuts to do this. They don't know yet at this time. Saudi nationals connected to the government in Riyadh might have aided some of the September 11 hijackers in the United States before they carried out their attacks, according to long classified portion of a congressional inquiry. They finally declassified this because they've been trying to protect the Saudis for all these years. But the word's getting out now that Saudi nationals connected to the government may have aided those 9/11 hijackers, as many people on this program who have come on over the years have said. Americans spending more money at retailers and factories revved up production in June, offering encouraging signs that the U.S. economy's resilience in the face of global headwinds continues. Registered investment advisor Michael Shedlock with us. Michael, what do you think about this latest story?
Well, a lot to go on here, George. There was a snapback today in industrial production reports, a snapback in last month's jobs report, as we've seen, and a snapback we've seen also in consumer spending. But that's all they were. If you average the last 2 months together, we're just sort of muddling through. All of this still depends on whether or not U.S. exports are going to keep up. China is increasingly a basket case. And my gosh, I heard your entire lead-in here on Turkey, George.
Can you believe that?
And your sources and my sources are saying the same things. I get emails from people all over the world. What you're hearing and what I'm hearing is not on mainstream media. Erdogan took over the press. He wants to establish an Islamic state. The U.S. supports this guy just because they're in NATO, and the U.S. wants our military bases over there.
And his son is making millions of dollars helping ISIS sell their oil.
Absolutely. Why don't we see these reports? You know this, George. I know this. We don't see this. It's like a anything that the U.S. doesn't want in the news isn't in the news. And it's in Nice, France. We've had Brexit. I was on this last weekend, if I can go there, and we taped a show, and it's going to be on later this year. And the first thing I said to you, George, was people are angry.
That was our Beyond Belief TV show.
The rise of Donald Trump in the United States, Brexit, these disasters in France, now Turkey. George, where does it stop?
I know. It's crazy. Mish, thanks. Have a good weekend. Mish was with me last weekend in Denver as we taped our Beyond Belief television program, so he'll be coming on an upcoming show. A man says he will do whatever it takes to keep his pet alligator after Florida wildlife officials told him it was way too big to roam in his garden. The retired firefighter, David Van Buren, has looked after this 13-foot male named Gwendolyn. Why'd they name an alligator that if he's a male? For 47 years. The creature, whose favorite treats include pizza and cookies, has been with him since he was a boy. He even took him to college with him. Well, what else is going on these days? Let's check with the Sky Man, Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hey, Pete, what do you got for us this week?
Good evening, George, and I'd like to preface by thanking you for alluding to the Holocaust of the Armenians back in the teens. That's a very, very important issue. I have a cousin whose wife hails from an Armenian family. I think it was her grandfather, walked for a week with no clothes and no shoes to escape being caught in that net.
Oh, it was horrible.
A horrible experience. And you've done more than the U.S. government in its entirety has done in calling that to the attention of the American people. You're to be commended. I have sort of a potpourri tonight, and I'd like to close with an appeal to the Coast listeners about an alleged crash that occurred down in Missouri in 1941. I think it's been covered a number of times.
Cape Girardeau, right?
Cape Girardeau. And I have an appeal, a request of the Coast listeners towards the end of my report. But I'd like to begin with a very, very interesting report that came to me last weekend from a senior aerospace engineer who spent 13 years from 1965 to 1978 at Vandenberg Air Force Base, working for a number of aerospace companies. You know, there have been rumors that our cameras, when they had missile launches out of Vandenberg, captured one or perhaps two UFOs tracking the missiles. This gentleman, and I invite people who have a technical bent to read his report that is linked to from our homepage on our website. He asserts, George, that senior executives down there at Vandenberg knew fully well that almost every launch was chaperoned by a UFO sighting.
Amazing.
They captured it with a telescope. They called it the Big Eye Telescope. I presume it was slaved to a Cine Theodolite, and they captured footage on every launch that he was aware of. They would take the footage, the film, to Building 7000 and view it shortly after the launch. Very, very interesting report. I talked at length to this gentleman. He speaks as clearly and eloquently as he writes, but I encourage that. I commend that report to the attention of Coast listeners who might like to know what was going on at Vandenberg in the 60s and 70s. Next case, a little more recent. This came to me Monday of this past week. Los Baños, California. You've probably driven by it many times or through it. This witness asserts that on Monday night at about 6 p.m. Pacific time, this is the 10th of July, 2016, he was driving south with his girlfriend and girlfriend's 12-year-old child. As they were about 10 minutes south of Los Baños, she suddenly screamed and awoke him from a short nap and pointed, and he looked up, and there was a creature in a long, dark robe with a hood on it. It's something straight out of Harry Potter. I think they're called the Death Eaters.
Or Stephen King.
Or even worse. But his description of this creature is very detailed. He looked the creature, he asserts in his report, directly in the eye, got a very good look at his face, and it was a scaled face. It was not skin. I am the most skeptical person you'll ever run into, George, when it comes to UFOs, but I spoke with this gentleman who submitted this report. He is an excellent source. The only cases I bring to this program, as I think you would guess, are the ones that are the very best I can produce and that I've tried to vet myself. I recommend that people read that report. It is very interesting. 11 minutes after that alleged sighting in Los Baños, going east now to Montreal, Canada, a woman was a very skilled sky viewer and astronomical photographer, was out taking photos. She took, I think, 9 or 10 photos in a row. She got a most interesting photograph that occurred just in an instant, captured it with her camera, using her 6-inch reflector telescope. Again, I am skeptical. I did not manage to get these photographs posted tonight, but I will very soon. It was priority number 13,684, and I just did not get to it, George. But over the weekend, I will have those photos posted. They look somewhat reminiscent of contrails. I'm a little bit skeptical, but I encourage people to read her report for the evening of the 10th. The final report comes from West Gardner, Maine. I don't know where it is. I think it's on the coast. Just about 2 hours after that sighting out of Montreal, a gentleman and his grown son were standing outside, 11:30 at night, and they saw, they report, a gigantic, round, perhaps disc-shaped blue object with blue lights around its periphery go just over the tops of the trees on the edge of their property. Very, very interesting report. And finally, closing with that crash disc in Cape Girardeau or that area of southeastern Missouri, I was approached by a group of people who are doing some very good research into that incident. I'm sure Linda Howe and others have looked into it as well. But they do not want any publicity. I told them that I would serve as a cutout for them. If any Coast listeners had family members or friends who were in southeastern Missouri during the early 1940s, who might have known something about it, or who might have left a diary that would register an allusion to that event, I'd invite them to contact me, and I will pass the information along to the researchers. So a lot going on, and I'll keep my eyes to the skies for sure, George.
You got it. Thanks, Peter. Love your reports. Okay, for the next several hours, let's try to forget about these tragic world events just for several hours and let our minds escape. Up next, Small Town Monsters with Seth Breedlove. Next. Okay, welcome back to Coast, an exciting couple hours here for you before we get into our Friday night and the Saturday morning open lines. Seth Breedlove is a film director, producer, writer, radio host. He has contributed content to numerous websites on a variety of topics. Back in 2013, Seth began researching the Minerva Monster case. After compiling an expansive library of information relating to that case, he made a film based on that flap. He has since directed two films, The Minerva Monster and The Beast of Whitehall, with a third on the way titled Boggy Creek Monster. These are all part of a series that he has created called Small Town Monsters. Seth produces these short films in his spare time. He co-hosts a radio show in Ohio, and here he is on Coast to Coast. I love your background, Seth. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, George.
These films that you started putting together, they got to be exciting for you to do that.
Yeah, no, it's an absolute thrill for me. I've always been in love with travel, and when you can travel and you're doing it while looking into something as interesting as, you know, Bigfoot cases or local monsters, things like that, it kind of combines two of my great passions, you know, travel and monsters and kind of the, you know, cultural impact of those things on the communities where we go. So we get to see a lot of America, and we get to see some really unique and kind of varying landscapes too. You know, I mean, we started in Minerva, Ohio, which isn't far from where I grew up, but then we moved from Minerva to Whitehall, New York, which is, you know, very mountainous. It's at the base of the Adirondack Mountains. A lot of our B-roll, you know, was shot in the mountains. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of hiking up into the mountains, and then we moved from there down to Falk, Arkansas, which is, you know, the lowlands and swamps of kind of that southern Arkansas area. So it's been completely different types of locations that we've headed to as well. So that's been awesome for us.
Seth, what came first, the travel, the general travel, or the monsters?
Oh, general travel. I grew up in a family that owned a bookstore. My parents owned a bookstore. So we used to do book shows all over the country as a kid. And I think it was somewhere in between all of that traveling that that kind of my love for this particular subject matter started to form. I think some of it was based on my mother, who grew up kind of in love with Ray Harryhausen movies and, you know, that old school kind of monster. And somewhere in between all of that, I did form like a kind of a love for cryptids, you know, even beyond Bigfoot, into things, you know, like chupacabra and lake monsters and things like that. And I know traveling, like we did, I was always looking out the windows of the car into the woods and wondering what was, you know, what was hiding out there that we didn't know about.
And you found out, too, that most small towns all had some kind of paranormal story or small town monster story attached to it, did you not?
It's every town. You know,
they have something.
Yeah, every town has their own monster, their own urban legend. I mean, and I'm honestly, usually it's a bunch of different cases. Usually you've got a crybaby bridge, and you've got, you know, a Bigfoot that hides out in someone's cornfield, you know, a farmer's cornfield, and you've got, you know, a guy with a hook for a hand over here. And, you know, there's numerous urban legends in every town, it seems like. And it's what's interesting to me, though, isn't just to find an urban legend in town, but find an urban legend in a town that seems rooted in some sort of reality. And I'm sure you know from what you've done for so long, but like you can kind of weed out, you know, what is probably folklore or folktale and what has some sort of realistic background. And for me, it's that, and then how that goes on to affect the community. Because as a kid, you know, we grew up hearing about the guy with the hook for a hand, and if you went and made out
stuck
on
yeah
hand,
stuck on the door
yeah you'd probably die. And but there's something different between that and then actually if you were to meet
the actual people who claim to have been stalked by the guy with a hook for a hand. That's what we're talking about here. When you talk about some of our projects and you can actually go and speak to the people who claim to have seen these monsters, that is for me.
That's fantastic.
What draws me,
Seth,
into it.
We're going to get into Minerva Monster, the Beast of Whitehall. When we come back, we'll talk about the Boggy Creek Monster as well. Well, so far, 754 members of the Turkish Armed Forces are being detained in that failed coup. You can kiss them goodbye. 40-plus people dead, 1,000 injured there. I'll keep updating you throughout the night. But for a while, let's just escape and let our minds go. And we're talking with Seth Breedlove about small-town monsters. And we're going to get into that in a second as well. We'll take calls with you next hour. So we have a countdown now to Asheville, North Carolina, because the days are really clicking by. The event is August 27th, and we really want you to participate and join us. Wherever you may be, come on out and have some fun. Simply go to the website, coasttocoastam.com, and click the picture that says George Norrie and Friends Living It Up in Asheville. Click that. That'll take you to the ticket page. And then look for the date August 27th. That's how they have it categorized. And then you'll be able to find the event. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Seth Breedlove with us. He's the film director, producer, writer, and radio host himself as we talk about Small Town Monsters, which, by the way, is his website. And it's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Seth, let's start with the Minerva Monster. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, Minerva Monster was a case that I was familiar with before I ever even really got into Bigfoot. One of the reasons, like I mentioned earlier, is that I grew up probably 20 minutes south of, or I guess it would be west of Minerva in Ohio. So I was familiar with it. I knew kind of the general location of where the event took place, but basically the story revolved around a particular family named the Caton family, who in the summer of 1978 started having frequent kind of visits from this upright walking hair covered being that would appear on the hill behind their home. And, you know, it started with small things like rocks hitting the top of the roof and, you know, just strange smells, and they could see glowing eyes in the woods and things like that. And it kind of escalated over the course of that summer. And when we investigated it, that was the story that we knew. We knew that 1978 they had had this sighting. We knew about this dog that had the family had owned that had turned up dead with its neck snapped. It had actually been ripped out of its leash and its neck had been snapped. And they came to believe that the creature had actually killed the dog. So they called the police this one particular evening when they were having a family get together, and the police showed up and investigated the story. And because of the police showing up, the Caton story hit the newswire. And after that happened, the Akron Beacon Journal and the Canton Repository, which are local papers, showed up to do stories on it. And from there, the story just kind of bloomed into this, you know, local kind of legend. I do know during the summer of 1978, it hit in a major way. It got out on the AP. News stations from Germany and Japan came to investigate the story. And then, of course, as always happens in these small town monster cases, you have scores of drunken kind of posses of men hunting monsters roaming around the woods behind
with shotguns and rifles, probably.
Shotguns and rifles. It was so bad that the sheriff told me that at one point there were so many cars parked along the Lincoln Highway, Route 30, that runs right in front of the Caton's house. There were so many cars parked along that road that they had to actually close down Route 30 because they couldn't find the posse of men that were up in the woods to get them back out to get their cars out of there. They did run men out of the woods, you know, threaten people. I don't know that anyone was arrested, but I do know that they had to, you know, basically leverage their police role and get guys out of the woods. There was a lot of, from what I was told, drunken hillbillies is the term that was commonly used. But we did find during the investigation that the sighting started well before, you know, 1978, when the story hit the AP. It had been going on for decades around Minerva, and particularly around the Catons home. Neighbors had seen this thing when they were younger, and even the Catons themselves had interactions going back to 1976.
And they really didn't want a lot of publicity about this, did they?
No, they contacted the police simply because they were starting to feel threatened by the monster at the time, and they never referred to it as a monster. The writer for the Akron Beacon Journal, Barbara Galloway, was the first person to kind of coin that term, Minerva Monster. And once that hit the AP, it became a whole mess for the family that they didn't really want anything to do with at all. They definitely didn't want publicity, and it definitely affected them in an extremely negative way. Once the town and particularly some of the kids that went to school with the Caton kids found out about this, it got extremely, just a lot of negative publicity for the family. Howie Caton told me that his senior year of high school, which would have been the year after all this happened, the following school year, was one of the most miserable years of his life.
It kind of backfired on everybody, didn't it?
Yeah, in a major way. They just, I really, and from talking to the family, I think it backfired in ways that they probably didn't even expect. They came to form kind of an attachment with the creature. In fact, some of the early articles talk about how the Caton family, viewed this monster almost as a family pet. So once people started hunting it, I think their perception of what had happened and how this all went down changed dramatically. Even their perception of how they viewed, the town at the time. Now that has changed today, but back then I think it was a very negative thing for them.
Are they still getting reports of this creature?
The family themselves, I can tell you this, the family themselves still have interaction with the creature.
They still live there, I guess.
They still live in the exact same spot. In fact, when we finished filming and editing Minerva Monster, the first thing we did was take the movie to the Caton family to show them before anyone had seen it. We wanted them to see the movie to make sure, this is okay with you guys. So we finished the film, and we actually took it to their house. And when we got there, Howie actually told us, he said we've had rocks thrown at the house in the last 2 weeks. So here we were in the Catons' living room watching Minerva Monster with them. And I just kept wondering, wouldn't it be something if while we're sitting here watching the movie, I hear rocks hit the roof? Because, for myself, just to have that.
Just thing, for you, that experience.
Right.
Yeah.
Just for me.
I love it. So what's the conclusion? And does the documentary have a specific conclusion? I don't want to give it away, but do you do that?
We try to let the witnesses tell their stories. We don't try to force a narrative or force an agenda. So basically, we're just letting people in and around Minerva tell their story and let the witness or let the viewers kind of draw their own conclusion. And that's not always the case, with small town monsters. I think every movie's going to have a slightly different storytelling kind of style. With Minerva Monster, there was no narrator. It was all simply these people telling their story, and we asked the viewer to almost play detective. If you want to think it's a black bear, because there were stories about black bear in the time, you could probably go with that story. Or if you want to say it was a guy in a suit, you could say that. But personally, from talking to everyone that was involved in that case, especially the Caton family, I come down on the side of something very unusual happened there. I mean, I don't think it was a guy in a suit, and I definitely don't think it was a black bear.
Oh, and I got to tell you, anybody who would be nutty enough to wear a suit out there with a bunch of people with shotguns and rifles is, asking for some problems.
Yeah, and you did ask about, activity going up till today. We were down there last summer, and there's definitely activity ongoing there. In fact, Howie told Brandon Dalo, who's my producer, Howie actually told him a story about the family being back in the woods after a certain time, and he told Brandon that the family knows not to be in this deep in the woods after this time because it's their turf. And he said that there were these howls and unusual noises that were going on, and the family was walking. He said something swung down from a tree, lifted him up by his shirt, and dropped him about 10 feet. And the family, the unusual thing about that, you hear stories like that, you know, not that story, but you hear a lot of stories like that if you're in this community, if you're involved in Bigfoot. But the thing is, as he's telling the story, he's got his entire family with him, and they're all backing up everything he's saying. So it's a very, definitely an ongoing case. And we take reports from that area, that kind of Stark County, Carroll County area of Ohio. There's a lot of reports out of that area.
Let's move on now to this Beast of Whitehall. Tell us about that.
Beast of Whitehall, whereas Minerva Monster kind of focuses on this very intimate little family story, Beast of Whitehall gets a little bigger because it involves eight members of law enforcement and these three teenage kids that kind of kickstart this whole thing known as the A-Bear incident, which is the tagline for Beast of Whitehall. Obviously, it's a fairly well-known story because Whitehall, New York, is kind of considered the Bigfoot capital of the East Coast. People refer to that town, you know, whenever you're talking about kind of the major landmark Bigfoot cases, people always talk about Whitehall, New York.
Yeah, this is upstate New York, right?
This is upstate New York, right at the base of the Adirondacks, right on the border with Vermont. Very mountainous, beautiful, rugged terrain. And anyway, these law enforcement officers and three teenage kids had this sighting in 1976. Three boys were out on a back road, A-Bear Road, and had an encounter with, again, an upright walking, you know, hair-covered creature. This one is constantly referred to as having red glowing eyes, which I always find, you know, highly unusual whenever you hear a Bigfoot sighting case, because it's just one of those things that adds another question mark.
And by the way, the covers of your films are perfect.
Yeah, Sam Sheeran does our posters for these. He's an amazing artist. We could not be happier with having someone as our poster artist. That guy has kind of sealed the deal for us, as it were. I mean, exactly. Those are amazing. But anyway, these kids are on this back road, and they sight this creature. They rush into town and get one of the boys' father, who was the police chief. Police chief comes back out. He's got eight other members of law enforcement from all around the state. This is not just Whitehall PD. This is State Highway Patrol and then state police were there as well. So they all come back out and they see this creature in the field. They watch it walk up a hill and out of the field. The next day, the boy's brother and the police chief's son, Brian Gosselin, comes back out to the sighting location for himself just to see if there's really anything going on. And Brian was extremely skeptical going into this. So he came out here. He had no intention of seeing a Bigfoot. He comes out to this location, and he sees one for himself. He actually encounters this creature in the field late at night by himself. And basically, from there, the story continued. The A-Bear incident is like a week-long series of events that took place that involved a lot of different people, law enforcement. And the unfortunate thing we did find out during the making of this project is that the A-Bear incident is a ton of different things that took place, and a lot of the stories have been lost to time due to the fact that, you know, there's a lot of the information is kind of under lock and key from local investigators and things like that. So there's a lot of moving pieces to the A-Bear story, and hopefully someday we can find out exactly what all went on, because what we capture in our movie is I can guarantee it's just a slice of what happened. And we did about the most thorough, in-depth look at that you could get, and it still is barely scratching the surface.
Boggy Creek in Arkansas. A lot of people know about this case, but for those who don't, Seth, give us some highlights.
The Boggy Creek Monster is a co-production we're doing with Lyle Blackburn, who's the writer of Beast of Boggy Creek, which is kind of the definitive look at the Boggy Creek story. We went down to Falk, Arkansas, simply to make kind of a look at You know, the stories behind the original Legend of Boggy Creek film that Charles B. Pierce made in 1971 and that was released in 1972. But what we ended up doing was making a very in-depth look at the modern-day sightings, what's going on up to present day in and around Falk, Arkansas. Everyone thinks of Falk, Arkansas. They think of those classic cases that are you know, kind of looked at in Legend of Boggy Creek. And what we found out is that there's sightings that took place all the way through the 80s, 90s, and up to today. So that is the main thrust of the movie, is going to be actually meeting modern witnesses, newer witnesses, and finding out what's been going on around Falk. The way our movies are handled is we do kind of a three-chapter narrative. There's a first chapter that kind of looks at the town and the town's history with the creature. Second chapter kind of goes into typically one particular story, and then third chapter kind of takes us up to today. Boggy Creek's going to be a little different. That middle chapter is going to be very different from what we did with Minerva or Whitehall. And it's going to look at these four specific cases from four different individuals, and you're actually going to get to go to their sighting locations and be on the ground kind of watching them walk around the location, explain where things took place. It's almost like a police procedural in that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're kind of piecing it all together for yourself. But geographically, what's really interesting to watch happen is to see where all these sightings are taking place and their proximity to things like Boggy Creek and Mercer Bayou, which if you've seen Legend of Boggy Creek, you'll know those names because they're constantly referenced even back in the 70s. But they're still going on today, and the sightings all seem to take place in these particular locations. So it's almost like a travelogue in that way, too.
You know, and when you put together the three films and look at each one individually and then kind of tie them together, you got to come away with the conclusion that creatures like Bigfoot have got to be out there, and they've got to be real.
You're putting me on the spot. This is like the do you believe question.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. See, I'm
come on, come on.
I'm still on the skeptical side, George. I don't know what it is, but I still have too many questions when I get into the logistics of it. How do we not have a body? And, you know, all the traditional things
sure.
skeptics say. And
yeah, but how often do we get the carcass of a bear?
Exactly.
Doesn't happen.
I've got all these, the responses down pat because I've given them to skeptics myself. But those lingering questions, until I can see something for myself and know for a fact, I'll probably always have those questions, but I will say that the stories like Whitehall, when I'm talking to Brian Gosselin in the spot where he saw his sight, you know, had his sighting, or I'm talking to Howie Caton where he saw the Minerva Monster, those are the things that continue to keep me involved in this and continue to keep me thinking there might be something still out there, because I really do hope there is. I love the idea.
It's a great idea. It's a foundation for everybody's imagination. But people are seeing something, Seth. You got to admit that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I don't think there's an easy answer to it. I don't subscribe to the hoax, explanation for everything, and I don't subscribe to the misidentified black bear, explanation. So it's a wonderful subject, and I was recently asked what it is about it that drew me to it. And I actually gave an answer I'd never really thought of, but it's something for me. I mean, I'm sure for everyone it's different, but for me, it's almost like a personal thing where there's something very innocent about the quest for an unknown animal, you know, that draws us back to being kids and running around through the woods and looking for, you know, something that we know might be there. We don't know if it actually is.
And we want to be scared, don't we?
Yeah, we do. We love it.
I don't know why, but the human mind wants to be scared.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And that's why I love telling these stories.
Website, of course, smalltownmonsters.com. Can people get to your films through the website?
Yeah. They'll be able to find where they can
get them
and buy it. It's shop.smalltownmonsters.com. And, of course, we've got numerous events coming up over the course of this summer, too. Around, we've got Minerva Monster Day in September, and we've got library screenings scheduled throughout the month as well.
Oh, cool. Okay, we're going to come back, Seth, and take some phone calls and stories for you next on Coast to Coast AM.